Chapter 21. The Ghetto is Liquidated. One night at the end of April 1943, we were awakened by the violent sound of gunshots. Although we anticipated action at any time, we were surprised. Everyone in the apartment hurried to our bunker. We took some of the neighbors along, since they knew about our hiding place and could pose a danger to us if they were left outside. The bunker was therefore overcrowded. The ghetto was surrounded. We heard the sounds of exploding grenades, wild gunfire, the barking of dogs, of breaking windows, cries and screams of Jews, and commands being shouted and spiked boots marching. Walls were torn down, iron bars and beams knocking down walls, floors, and ceilings. We were like sardines crushed together in the hot, sticky air of the small room. Soon everyone was thirsty and sweated from fear. Children cried and wanted to relieve themselves. Parents pressed their hands tighter over the mouths of their children when they heard boots approaching. Every house was searched thoroughly. While looking for us, the Nazis looted. They stole textiles, leather, and jewelry, hidden between walls and in the bunkers. About 25 men, women, and children were in our bunker. We repeatedly heard the command, "Give up! Leave the bunkers!" This was accompanied by the sound of exploding hand grenades and gunfire. Between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, they searched our house for the first time. We heard the noise of walls, doors, windows, and cupboards being torn down, and a ram battering the walls, and repeated commands, "Hauruck!" Everyone realized the seriousness of the situation. Every movement, a cough, and the slightest noise could have meant death for us all. The deadly silence in the bunker was sustained with our final concentration of energy. I no longer remember whether it was 20 or 30 hours that we spent in that state with dry throats being pressed against each other. I am convinced that no person would choose to go through such torture, even to save their lives, if they knew in advance what it would be like. Once in such a situation, however, the will to survive seems to grow stronger. I discovered that not only in me, but in many of my fellow sufferers. We also knew what awaited us, but we resisted, more out of instinct than logic. Our tormentors approached us in groups of 4 or 6 at short intervals. We heard them shouting orders and pounding on the walls and ceilings. Then they disappeared again with their booty of people and goods. The occasional moments of silence were broken by screams and heartbreaking sobs and the whistle of isolated gunshots. We in the bunker were completely exhausted. The air was asphyxiating. The stench of sweat, excrement, and urine was everywhere. We could hardly breathe. The 3 or 4 children in the bunker reacted like adults. They did not say a word, did not cough, cry, or complain. They acted with the instinct of little animals. We hoped that this action would soon stop and that the SS would disappear. We then could leave the bunker as we had done after previous actionen, which never lasted so long. We were in the bunker for 2 days and 2 nights when we heard a new wave of attacks on our house. Again they were in the house, above us, and in the courtyard. This time it was more serious. They came in a group with crowbars and battering rams. Our persecutors knew from experience that the bunkers were not located in cellars directly under the houses, but on the sides. Cellar bunkers were easy to find because of the hollow sound they made when tapped. They therefore pounded the outer walls of the house until they heard a hollow sound. They rammed the walls near our heads until they finally hit the upper corner of our bunker. Fortunately, they hit only the corner. The ram brushed it and penetrated the sidewall. Thus they could not detect a hollow spot. A deathly silence prevailed in the bunker. It was completely dark. The sound of the battering ram could be heard above our heads. Breathlessly we sat there, only seconds and centimeters from the killers. More and more dust fell from the ceiling onto our heads. That was not a good sign. Perhaps we would suffocate before being discovered. Any end was preferable to this torture. Suddenly a rammed-in block of wood brought a ray of light into the darkness of the bunker. The murderers did not notice anything. The men and women sitting in the corner moved their heads to let the ram drive into the wall. They then covered the corner with a blanket in order to prevent the light from revealing our presence. It took about 30 to 40 minutes before the persecutors gave up. They pulled out the ram, and we filled up the hole with clothes to stop any light from entering. Just when we thought that the search was over, the Nazis reappeared, this time at the toilet entrance to our bunker, which we had considered absolutely safe. Later we learned that they had discovered a neighboring bunker and were given the location of our hideout by a young man who knew something about it. Under the threat of smoking us out with grenades, they ordered us to leave the bunker immediately. In such a moment there is neither the time nor the possibility for discussion. It was enough for one person to weaken and stick his head out. One of my typhus-infected comrades was close to collapsing. He panicked and emerged first. A bullet smashed his leg. We crept out of the bunker with raised hands. We had spent 2.5 days there and were herded with bayonets into the marketplace. In 1947, in Marburg, an der Lahn, I recognized the man who had revealed our hiding place. I found no reason to reproach him at this time, but I did not want to talk with him either. On the morning of April 30th, 1943, my birthday, I fell into the clutches of our murderers. Several hundred men, women, and children were herded together at the gathering point of the Majiacek ghetto, and many more joined us. We were forced to sit on the ground with our hands over our heads. It was the end of all our dreams and illusions. Death seemed to come closer. Death by gas, shooting, or torture. There was no way out, and no possibility of escape. That I tried to save myself until then was of little consolation. At the gathering point, I could see many acquaintances from Rajin. I also saw my child with her aunt and uncle. Apparently all Jews had been caught during the raid. The ghetto was to be destroyed and all the Jews liquidated. Terrible scenes took place. Most of them sat there apathetically for hours. Others had already been shot. Children cried, and mothers who tried to help them, thereby attracting attention, were worked over with rifle butts. Some people were randomly chosen in order to reveal bunkers which still existed. If they said nothing, they were beaten. When a woman became hysterical, a guard pressed a pistol against her neck and fired. Thus were confessions extorted. Was our bunker also betrayed in that way? As we lined up in rows of five, the Nazis noticed that some children without parents remained in the marketplace. They were probably lost in the chaos, or their parents had been shot. The SS men would hold their pistol against the children's necks and fire. Endlösung. In the afternoon, we were led through the city to the train station. How the ghetto looked and how we felt have already been described. Outside the ghetto, the world looked normal, almost normal. In my eyes, the people also looked that way. I did not see a sign of compassion in the Poles' faces. They knew that the possessions given to them for safekeeping had become their own property forever, and that when we marched, any remaining debts could be regarded as settled. Many Jews grasped each other's hands tightly so as not to get lost. There were men and women, sisters and brothers, friends, lovers, sons and daughters, who did not want to leave their feeble parents in their hour of need. Small children in the arms of their mothers who clasped them like pliers. One often heard the muted crying, then shots, and silence. In great disarray, accompanied by shouted commands, we were beaten and shoved by rifle butts into waiting cattle cars. Families and friends were mercilessly torn from each other. Those who managed to stay together in spite of it all felt that they had achieved a victory. Dogs were let loose to bite us and tear our clothing to shreds. The doors were locked behind us and bolted. The small windows in the car were covered with a barbed wire. Through them, however, we got some fresh air and light. We could breathe and calm ourselves. We felt that we were at least safe from rifles and dogs. We soon became aware of hunger, thirst, and other basic human necessities. All these people had suffered 20 or more hours of unimaginable torture behind them, hours that seemed endless and which did not allow for the fulfillment of human needs. Occasionally a member of the Judenrat or the Jewish militia was discovered, only days or hours before he was serving our tormentors, but now he too became a victim and shared the tragic fate of all Jews. Passively and silently they endured the curses, the spitting, and the blows of their fellow sufferers. What could they have been thinking at that time? One must be thankful for having been spared such ordeals. It took a few hours before the train finally started. Some young men had knives and chisels. The cutting work started immediately. About 2 hours after departure, a hole in the car wall was opened so wide that one could lift the bolt on the outside and slide the door open. In the meantime, night had come. The rattle of the train could be heard along with the shots of the guards who sat in booths between the cars. When the train moved slowly, the shots fell along the ditches, but always closer to the car doors. Operation Tralala, jumping off trains, had begun. Many people leaped, many died. I too wanted to jump. It was difficult to decide. I knew that I was the last survivor of my family, that I had lost my child and my chevra, and I was one of the last of the 60 Jews from Rajin. In that dilemma, I spoke with my cousin, Miriam Blumenkopf. She was much older than I, and physically could not jump from the train. Her 13-year-old daughter had already died in the ghetto. I asked her if she could tell me where she had hid some valuables so that I would have some money if my leap for freedom succeeded. Her husband had been a rich jeweler and had hidden or entrusted many valuables to Polish families for safe keeping. She rejected my request. I was neither angry nor offended. She probably had not understood the situation as yet. I do not know how many people jumped from the train that night, but it must have been a good number, since the shooting never stopped. Our crowded car was almost half empty when we arrived. I also do not know how many were shot and how many survived. I never met one of the jumpers. However, I did not jump. We tried to orient ourselves to our destination. We knew that our train was bound for an extermination camp, but we did not know which one. Would it be Treblinka, Auschwitz, or Majdanek? Early the next morning, we arrived at Majdanek.